The court calls U.S. v. Fletcher. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Rob Michaels, and together with Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter, we represent the appellant, Specialist Thomas Fletcher, in this case. In the appellant's case, the purported victim, S.H., testified that while she was being sexually assaulted by Specialist Fletcher, she did not scream nor did she fight back because she was scared and embarrassed. The government then presented the testimony of Ms. Sarah Falk, a putative expert who testified that victims of sexual assault almost never scream and almost never fight back because they are scared. The military judge abused his discretion when he allowed a putative expert to testify under a stamp of scientific certainty that she had interviewed thousands of victims of sexual assault, and these victims most commonly act the same way S.H. did. The logical inference which the panel was left with was that because S.H. didn't fight back and didn't scream, she was sexually assaulted. The trial counsel then argued this inference during rebuttal to impermissibly bolster the testimony of S.H. in a hotly contested case. The military judge then compounded the error by stopping the defense counsel from cross-examining the expert on the fundamental question as to whether her opinions have been proven to be true or accurate by court of law, and by denying them their own expert who was qualified and able to debunk Ms. Falk's baseless assertions.
You make a fair number of different arguments in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
You got some Daubert going on, you got 702.
Yes,
and,
Your Honor.
And one might even say there's a little bit of a kitchen sink in there. What's the core of your argument if you were going to say, well, if you only have one argument to make, which argument would you focus on?
Your Honor, I would focus on the government's expert testified not to counterintuitive behavior. She testified what judge seemed to be implying, and through his litigation and through the record that was established, there seemed to be an expectation that she was going to testify that some victims do this and some victims don't. Some victims call law enforcement, some victims don't. But what Ms. Falk actually testified to was victims almost never scream and victims almost never fight back. That was not what the government proffered. And looking at the record itself, during the litigation on this issue, Joint Appendix 218, the trial counsel themselves says she wasn't qualified to testify about that. That was outside of her area, and she wasn't qualified to testify as to why these things happened.
So the core, in response to my question, then your answer is the legal issue is that she was not qualified as an expert to conclude that victims almost never scream or fight back.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that a fair?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And looking that back with Daubert, you know, understanding that this court has held. There's no rigid set structure by which one of these hearings should find itself. There's no way that it should look. That the military judge is given wide latitude in how to conduct that hearing.
Why isn't she a person providing specialized knowledge?
She could have been, Your Honor.
Based on experience.
She could have been based off of her experience. Where her qualification failed and where the military judge's Daubert analysis failed was that she was not, by the government's own admission, she wasn't qualified to give the testimony that she gave. And during the course of the litigation, at one point, the military judge, during the 39A, when doing the voir dire of Ms. Falk, the military judge directs trial counsel to ask her the three questions that he had said were permissible. And all that happened was the trial counsel seemed to have recited them back to the military judge, and the military judge never heard the answer. And he said at that point that he wanted to be, quote, darn sure of what she was going to say. And the answer never came. The purpose of Daubert is to ensure the relevance and reliability of that testimony. Had Ms. Falk answered the questions at that point, he would have seen that, one, it wasn't counterintuitive behavior as the government was proffering, and two, she had no basis to make those assertions that she made.
What was she qualified? Well, leaving aside her qualifications as an expert at all, what did the judge qualify her as an expert on? He gave what seemed to me to be a very convoluted, she's an expert on this, but she's not an expert on that, and the two to me sound exactly the same. What did the judge qualify her as an expert on?
The exact quote, Your Honor, was, "Ms. Falk will be recognized as an expert in sexual assault," and then there was a pause, "as a sexual assault response coordinator." He then clarifies, "not the sexual assault victim response," or however you put it, according to the trial counsel. What the difference there is, Your Honor, I don't know. It seems that he's military.
Well, he said she's a sexual assault response coordinator. That's not an expert. That's her job.
Yes, sir.
Right?
Absolutely, sir.
Right. He's saying, okay, he's basically saying she's employed as one of these people. And then he's saying she's an expert on what? Or is he just saying she's not an expert on something?
He said his exact language, sir, was sexual assault response coordinator. That's what he qualified her as an expert in.
Well, that's her job, right?
Yes,
and that,
sir.
How she's employed, that's her job title.
Yes, sir. And how that gets back to counterintuitive behavior, or what, which was what the government was proffering.
Well, my question is perhaps a broader one. How does that get back to anything? I mean, I suppose in one sense, anyone who is employed is an expert in what he's employed in, but that seems to be a truism. How do you read this?
Your Honor, I read this that the military judge didn't know what she was an expert in. That she was proffered as a counterintuitive behavior expert, and she didn't testify to it.
Did the defense object to her being qualified as an expert?
Yes, Your Honor, they did. Understanding, as the government asserts in their brief, that they didn't object when those limits were set and she blew by.
They objected later.
They objected later. They objected to their substitute. They objected.
Does that preserve the objection? Does that preserve the issue?
We believe it does, Your Honor. And understanding the government's reliance on Johnson, that Johnson says that it is the defense counsel's job, once the limits are set by the military judge, if they go past those limits and exceed those limits, that it's on the defense counsel at that point to object. We, one, believe that the objections that were made to her testifying at all, to the relevancy of her testimony, to the hearsay, all the objections that they made running up is enough to preserve it. But even if it isn't, Johnson still evaluates it for plain error. And in this case, if the court determines that it wasn't objected to at that specific point, such that we're at plain error, I believe this error was plain. The military judge heard the government counsel say she was not qualified to testify as to why victims do this. And then that testimony came in. And this is only moments after he had said, here are the specific things I'm going to allow her to say, or allow you to ask, and we're not going to go to these specific topics, being stranger versus non-stranger. And then she went into it. At that point, even if this court doesn't believe that the objections that led up to it and the objection afterwards were enough to preserve that, we still believe that we meet plain error. And looking at Johnson specifically, one of the things that made Johnson not plain error were two of the Daubert tools that Daubert laid out for what the remedy is or what the approach is when you have shaky but admissible expert testimony. And one is vigorous cross-examination, and the second is presentation of contrary evidence. The military judge stopped the cross in this case. They stopped defense counsel from asking a question which went to the underlying reliability of Ms. Falk's testimony, as to what basis, whether this testimony had ever been, her basis of opinion had ever been tested in the court of law, what the conviction rate was. And given that that answer had been given in the 39A, she said at least a fourth, and she was very hesitant as to what exactly the ratio was in her opinion. And she said she wouldn't be able to give an accurate. The government had good reason for not wanting that in, and that was because it would severely undermine their case. The government themselves admitted during the litigation that preceded the trial itself that their case would be deficient without this testimony. And what happened at the end as far as prejudice is the government then stood up on rebuttal and argued testimony which they themselves admitted their expert was not qualified to give. Going back to what the military judge's error, had a proper Daubert analysis been conducted, he relied on the proffer that came from the defense of the trial counsel as to what she was going to testify to. And she came in and testified, and I think it's a fair characterization, say exactly the opposite. She didn't testify that some do this and some do that. She testified they almost never do this. They almost never scream, and they almost never fight back.
What's your position on the fact that she didn't tie it into the facts in this case at all?
Your Honor, there's precedent from this court, which they don't have to have specific knowledge about the case. They don't have to have specific knowledge about the victims or the facts of this case. And
if that's the case, what 702.3 mean?
I think it's a factor of the Daubert analysis that's supposed to be conducted. There's got to be some relevancy to this. I also point out that the military judge himself said during the email exchanges and during the 39As on this that it seems to be almost common sense. And they asked the question during voir dire, and the panel members were all open to the idea that nobody acts the same. So what information, how this was helpful, don't feel that had a proper analysis been conducted under Daubert, that this evidence would have passed muster such that it had become admissible. As far as, you know, her not having any knowledge about this case, but it wasn't that she didn't have any knowledge about this case. The government went to great pains to say that she had no interaction with the victim. She had reviewed nothing. I believe the only thing that she said she knew about the case was she had met the victim, supposedly, in the witness waiting room. That goes to, you know, it should be a factor in a Daubert analysis as to how this is relevant, how this is helpful for the panel in making their determination.
So wait, so to understand your answer is so long as it is relevant, you would read 702.3 as met.
No, Your Honor, we still have to meet the other, we still have to meet the other prongs of the rule. We still have to meet the other as far as the methodology that was.
No, I get that part, but one would satisfy 702.3 merely by demonstrating that the specialized knowledge was relevant to the case.
I think it needs to be relevant and helpful. And in this
fair
case,
enough, but it doesn't have to, in fact, be related to the facts of the case, as long as it's relevant.
Your Honor, again, the case law has said that they don't have to have specific knowledge about this case. So, we understand, but we do think it's a factor that the military judge should have considered. And had that analysis been conducted, and we're not saying that it had to be in a set form, that it had to be in a set hearing, and there was, in fact, some voir dire on that issue. But had the military judge actually heard the answers that she proposed to give, when he asked the trial counsel to give those answers, he would have seen that she was not testifying to what the government was proffering she was going to testify to.
Well, then, what exactly is the issue that you're relying on? Is it the fact that he didn't hold a Daubert and we don't really know what the analysis was, or the fact that his ultimate analysis was wrong, or some combination of the two?
I think it's a combination, Your Honor, because we don't expect them to do follow a set procedure. But they still have to meet the determination that it is reliable. And this court has looked at, and I believe in United States versus Griffin, while the standard is abuse of discretion as to whether the testimony is admissible, court reviews de novo whether Daubert or 702 was appropriately applied. And in this case, all we have are legal conclusions from the judge saying, in my past experience, this is what these folks have testified to, therefore I'm going to allow you to ask these three questions.
But what he said is, in my experience, this is what they testify to isn't what she testified to.
Exactly, Your Honor, which is why we believe that the military judge's decision in this case was an abuse of discretion. And applying de novo to whether he followed the proper analysis, we believe he did not. As far as prejudice, this was a hotly contested case. The government asserts in its brief that this was not a hotly contested case. It was a hotly contested case, as is evidenced by the fact that the panel found him not guilty of one of the charges that was contested. And the government themselves said during the litigation that their case would be deficient without this testimony. So what they did was they brought in an expert who testified because, in essence, the logical inference that could be drawn from what Ms. Falk said was because she didn't scream, because she didn't fight back, that she, in fact, had been sexually assaulted. And the government counsel argued evidence to the panel on rebuttal that they themselves admitted their expert was not qualified to give.
Counsel, in your opinion, would the voir dire of the expert have been sufficient if the military judge had her actually answer the questions?
I think it would, Your Honor. I think that would be a much stronger case for the government at that point if he had actually heard the answers from the witness. Because he relied on the proffer. He relied on the proffer.
Did the government actually proffer those as her answers, or weren't those his supposition as to what the answers would be based on his experience as to what like people testified about?
I believe looking back at the email litigation and what was on the record, there was a combination of both. The military judge did say this is what these folks have testified to in the past and laid it out. But I believe there is an email, Your Honor, where he said the government proffers this is, in essence, what she's going to be saying. And that was in the context of why the defense did not need their own expert, Dr. Greiger. So I believe there was a combination of the two. I see my time has expired. Subject to your questions, this concludes my argument.
Thank you very much. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Daniel Carta, along with co-counsel Major Robert Rodriguez. We represent the United States in this case. This court should affirm because, one, the record shows that the military judge conducted a sufficient Daubert gatekeeping analysis. Two, Ms. Fault was properly qualified as an expert under the six prongs of U.S. v. Hauser. And three, any assumed error by the admission of Ms. Fault's testimony is harmless. First, regarding the Daubert gatekeeping analysis, the military judge's actions were sufficient and amounted to a Daubert hearing. The military judge allowed both government and defense counsel to argue their respective sides, first via email, second through written motions, third via oral argument at Article 39A session at trial, and fourth through voir dire of the expert, Ms. Falk herself.
What's she an expert on?
The military judge qualified her as an expert as a sexual assault response coordinator.
That's her job title.
Yes, Your Honor.
She's an expert at being a sexual assault response, SANE, or was it, whatever the acronym
SARC.
Is. SARC.
That's right.
Okay. What's she an expert on? He gave this extremely confusing statement. She's an expert, she's this, but she's not this, and they sound exactly the same.
Yes,
what are we to take from this record as to what he's qualifying her for? And then she gives this sweeping testimony. Where's all this come from? What are we to make of this?
Your Honor, this court should make, it is, you know, somewhat confusing that.
It's more than somewhat confusing. It's, to me, totally confusing, but go ahead.
Essentially, she was qualified to testify on sexual assault responses and victims.
Can you speak up?
As a sexual assault responses and victims, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
If I can follow up on that, initially when the military judge asked the government what she was going to testify to, they said that she was going to testify to common behaviors and responses she has experienced with sexual assault victims. Then they moved to have her recognized as an expert as a sexual assault in sexual assault victim responses. The military judge said he was not going to, well, first he said he was going to recognize her as an expert as sexual assault response coordinator, not in sexual assault victim responses. So he specifically said, I'm not going to allow her to be an expert in the area that you asked her to be in. And there seems to be some difference in his mind between the two that he didn't want those responses. And so I agree with Judge Dookie. I'm not sure what the difference is, what she was qualified to, because he specifically said she wasn't being recognized for what the government asked her to be qualified as.
Yes, Your Honor. Trying to get into the military judge's mind, it seems based on what was argued during the motions practice and what led up to that in Article 39A, it seemed to me that he was trying to distinguish between what the government was trying to ask three questions on limited testimony, basically how often type of questions to get.
Our problem here is that since he didn't hold a formal Daubert hearing, we don't know what he was thinking.
Well, actually, Your Honor, the military judge specifically asked, our point is that it was an actual Daubert hearing, even if it wasn't in limine and it go through all the factors. He specifically asked the government counsel to, I want to know what she's going to say or words to that effect. And for whatever reason, the trial counsel, instead of asking those questions, he wanted to get one extra bit of information in and that kind of sidetracked the discussion. And eventually, those three questions were never asked. But the military judge intended to ask those questions. It wasn't the fact that he just didn't even think of it because he wasn't thinking about the Dalbert factors, about MRE 702.
Go ahead.
It's just for whatever reason, essentially the Article 39A got sidetracked, and unfortunately, those three questions were never asked right before she actually was called to testify.
Is this even a body of knowledge within the meaning of the rule or Daubert? This seems, whatever she seems to be, quote, an expert in, seems to be so vague and broad and flabby that it either means everything or nothing. Which goes back to her fundamental qualifications to testify at all. What is this body of knowledge?
Well, the body of knowledge, I think, goes to the third prong of Hauser, or the basis. And we know it's well settled in the case law we cited to our brief that there's no requirement for experts to interview the victim before testifying.
That's not what I'm asking.
Like the body of knowledge?
I'm asking, what's she an expert in? This seems to be so hazy that it makes me wonder whether there's even a body of knowledge in which she could be qualified.
Why don't you take a look at the Rule 702, for example, and tell us under what aspects of the rule is this testimony coming in your view? Is it scientific, technical, or otherwise specialized knowledge?
It'd be technical or otherwise special knowledge.
And is it based on qualification of the expert by knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education?
Primarily,
this isn't a fill-in-the-blank quiz, but then you're supposed to say why and how's that demonstrated in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. It's for instance, she was, so far as her knowledge and experience, especially her experience, she testified she interviewed thousands of sexual assault victims. So she has a wide body of experience that she can draw upon. Perhaps she doesn't have the, you know, postgraduate. She's not a psychiatrist or psychologist, but we know from the case law that's not required. You can have people who just have bachelor's degrees or have a whole lot of experience as she does in this case, and that can wholly qualify an expert. Additionally, we also know that it's logically relevant for experts to explain that certain behavior patterns occur in certain percentage of rape cases, as she does here.
Counsel, let's take a look at 702 in view of the 2004 amendment that was made. And that was an identical amendment that was made to the federal rules, and it was adopted in the military rules verbatim. And when we look at the comments to the federal rule, they recognize that experts can testify based on their experience. And what they said was that if the witness is relying solely or primarily on experience, then the witness must explain to the panel how that experience leads to the conclusions that were reached, why that experience is a sufficient basis for the opinion, and how that experience is reliably applied to the facts. So where in the testimony of this expert do we have any of those criteria?
Well, she explains, based on her training and experience, that, you know, she's interviewed all these different victims over the years. And there's, like, in all the cases we've cited, an expert can testify as to a kind of a bigger picture. You don't have to get into the specific details. And in fact, Judge Wiss, in the concurring opinion in Hauser, specifically states that an expert who's appropriately distanced from the alleged victim.
The problem, counsel, that you have here, I mean, maybe it's a problem, maybe it isn't, but I mean, this is not an individual who is interviewing these people in an adversarial manner. It's not a person who's investigating them. It's not a person who's treating them. It's a person who's their advocate, right? And so in the absence of any sort of methodology or critical analysis of what she is relating, how is it anything more than just an anecdotal opinion? So, for example, I probably know more Wheaton Terriers than anyone else in this room, but would I be qualified as an expert to testify in a court of law that, in my experience, Wheaton Terriers don't bite, when the question was whether someone had bitten someone? Right?
Understand, Your Honor. It's not just...
I mean, it's not exactly the same, but I'm just saying, it's like, you know, that's my experience, so fine.
I mean, besides the depth of experience she has in thousands of cases, I mean, she's had training specifically as a rape counselor in SART. She's had
but she didn't talk about how that training related to her opinion in this case, did she?
No, because the judge was limiting her responses to those three questions.
But she didn't limit her responses, did she, when she was actually asked the questions?
When she did elaborate on each question as to the how. Specifically, the judge, and I think this goes back to what was, I believe, the primary motive by the appellant and the original motions practice was to get their expert in, Dr. Grieger. When that didn't happen, the military judge, I believe, as trying to be a fair and balanced going both ways, the military judge ordered that, okay, well, we're going to have this expert testify, but we're not going to go allow her to go too much into the how, and that's where the government said that we're not having Ms. Tull come in to go into the psychoanalysis.
Right, because she's not qualified to do it, but then when she answered the question, she did exactly that.
Well, she was just saying what the victim
and the military judge had specifically said that he wasn't going to allow her to be asked the question about strangers, right, or people that were known, but she somehow managed to get that into her answer, even though it wasn't responsive to the question?
Yes, Your Honor. It's unfortunate that she exceeded the scope of what the military judge said, but again, we point to U.S. v. Johnson that it's incumbent upon the defense to protest any transgressions of the limiting of the scope of testing.
But when she answered specifically what the government had said that she couldn't do and what the military judge said she couldn't do, why wasn't it incumbent on the military judge to instruct the members to disregard her answer as outside the scope of her expertise?
Well,
as a sexual assault response coordinator.
Yes, Your Honor. The military judge could have, but we would again point to her answer was a one-sentence explanation going further into not only how many of these people said almost never, but a little bit into the why.
Then why isn't it plain error?
Excuse me?
Why isn't the judge's failure to do that, and why is the fact that it went in anyway not plain error, regardless of whether the defense objected at that time?
Well, it's not plain error, Your Honor, because, I mean, it just wasn't that important. I mean, first we know that
it's not plain error because it wasn't that important. Isn't the whole case turn on this? Isn't a large part of the defense case the fact that he's sleeping out there, he heard nothing, she said nothing, she did nothing? How is it not important to the outcome of this case? How is this response or lack of response and testimony about, very general testimony about the lack of response, not important in this case? And if it went in and the judge said it wasn't going to go in, why isn't it plain error?
Well, on why it's not important, it was important enough that it was probative enough to get into the case to begin with.
Well, counsel, if it was so important, I mean, there's pretty well-settled case law, right, that experts in counterintuitive behavior are permissible, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, if it was so important, why didn't the government get a highly qualified, credentialed expert with no emotional attachment to the issues in the case to testify?
Well, they did that, Your Honor. She was highly qualified. We already talked about thousands of victims. And specifically, she didn't interview the victim. She didn't read any of the facts.
So are you now testifying that she testified as to the basis for counterintuitive behavior?
No,
the psychological basis?
The government doesn't dispute that her testimony went to generally the topic of counterintuitive behavior, right? But what we're saying, or trying to say, is essentially that in this case it actually helped that she wasn't reading all the case materials and such. Because again, as Judge Wiss said, such an expert is appropriately distanced from the alleged victim is in a position to offer truly objective evidence to the fact finders.
Well, counsel, I doubt that you'll find many defense counsel that would agree that a SARC or a SANE is distance from a victim in any case. But I go back to my question, which is, why didn't the government get, if this was so important, an expert as to the psychological bases for counterintuitive behavior as opposed to an anecdotal reminiscence about what this person had experienced with the people that she had interviewed and represented but not treated or investigated? Well, do you see the difference?
No, I see. I think it just might be some confusion. I thought you meant the specifically, you were saying that Ms. Falk had no involvement with this victim in this case, not all the other victims that she had prior had the thousands of evaluations and interviews with. I'm just saying,
you would agree she most likely wasn't appropriately distanced from them, right? I mean, she was their advocate.
Right, all those thousands of victims, yes, Your Honor. But in this case, not the victim, not Mrs. S.A. Ms. S.A. She was appropriately distant from her because, as the government pointed out, and there.
I understand your position.
I'm a little concerned about the reliability of her observations because she testified that she never questioned whether or not the assaults actually occurred or in the manner in which they occurred. She took her job was to take what they told her as the truth and go from there. And so what she's testifying to is responding to people in situations where we don't really know whether or not, you know, that is what actually happened. And so I'm wondering, as to the reliability aspect, how that fits into this. And I'm wondering particularly in regard to your brief on page 46, where you note that, talk about the defense counsel's closing argument, and that it put the expert's testimony in perspective for the members, as her testimony, there was no way to verify its credibility, given the second nature of her sources. So if that is a good capsulization of her testimony, how can that be reliable testimony? And isn't that something for the military judge to initially look at in the Daubert hearing up front?
Well, the military judge, there was evidence that he, actually during the voir dire itself, they asked Ms. Falk, the expert, how many cases did, and I think this was the defense cross of her, how many cases did she know eventually went to court-martial, and how many of those, I believe she said, and then asked how many times of those did they actually get a conviction. She said at least a quarter. There's some evidence, and that, of course that was not in front of the panel, but that established that there's at least some reliability of what she was saying with the thousands of victims. I think it's common sense that it's at least a majority of the allegations and sexual assault are not false allegations. I mean, I think we can all agree on that. If that's the case, it at least meets that low hurdle of relevancy under Hauser, under the fourth prong. And so far as our response to
reliability. Let's talk about reliability.
Yes, sir.
I'm not questioning relevance.
Well, it was reliable as well. Because, I mean, for the same reasons you already said, but getting back to our response or characterization of the cross-examination by defense counsel, yes, they pointed out those weaknesses inherent to her testimony, but that doesn't mean that it's not relevant and not reliable enough to come in under the low standard. We're just pointing out.
I mean, how low is the standard? I mean, I understand it's a low standard, but is it a meaningless standard?
No, not at all, Your Honor. I mean, this is
so. How much less reliable could her methodology be and still be enough to meet the standard?
I mean, if she came in and said basically that I talked to maybe 10 people and they told me this and told me that, I had no prior training, I haven't had my 120 hours of various sexual assault response courses as a victim advocate, I haven't had all this other training, that if I just, essentially that would devolve into a lay witness. which she at least has. And we have, and we cited a number of cases where you don't have to have even a master's degree. We've had social workers with just a bachelor's degree and a lot lower number of cases than Ms. Falk has. One case that interviewed, I think, 30 people or 10 people, and that was found to be valid.
But can you just explain to me, based on the basis that she gave for her opinion, which is she's interviewed 1,000 putative victims, right, in her job as a SAR or related jobs. And because of that, she thinks that this is, you know, lots of them don't do X and lots of them don't do Y. Can you differentiate for me between that observation and just a pure anecdotal observation?
I mean, she had, again, these thousands of victims. It's not a small sample to start with. I mean, 2,000.
I'm just talking about because of the nature of her relationship with them, right, and the manner in which she interacted with them. How is it anything more than an anecdotal observation?
I think you can first rely on her training that she had. She did, there is, again, testimony during voir dire that she actually did know because she interacted with the prosecutors and others that she was able to find out, at least in some of the cases, she was able to follow them and see that they went to court-martial, that some were actually convicted. I mean, this isn't just any layperson just sitting there listening to even 1,000 people come to tell her. She had the training. She went and actually followed up with some of these people. But I see past my time.
You can answer the question for sure.
And I think that essentially sums up our position on, so far as her training and expertise. I mean, yes, there is some point where if somebody has no training and no experience or background or anything, and then just has labor or people come in and tell them things, anecdotal evidence, you put it, Your Honor.
And I'm not doubting that she has, that she's qualified to have the job that she has, and I'm not doubting that she dealt with the people that she dealt with and has the opinion that she has, right? I'm just questioning how it is transformed into an expert opinion based on reliable methodology.
Understood, Your Honor.
I understand.
Well, I hope I...
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Councilor Appellant, you have the opportunity for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, picking up where Captain Carter left off, government now is proffering that Ms. Falk was a highly qualified counterintuitive behavior expert. That was not what they proffered at trial. In fact, there was specific litigation where government counsel was trying to say she wasn't a counterintuitive behavior expert, which is how they justified denying Dr. Breitman. I draw the court's attention to JA Joint Appendix 113. The military judge says, apparently we were all under the impression that the government was bringing in an expert to talk about counterintuitive behavior, and the government informed us in the 802 this morning in chambers that they are not necessarily going to ask her about counterintuitive behavior.
Counsel, do you disagree that that the government could call an expert in counterintuitive behavior?
No, Your Honor, we don't. We don't disagree with that.
So what precisely is the issue that you take with this particular expert?
She didn't testify about counterintuitive behavior, Your Honor. She testified, I believe, the exact opposite, saying they almost never scream, they almost never fight back, and the government used that to link in, to justify, and to explain.
But what precisely is your problem with what it was that she said?
The almost never. There's a quantification which went to credibility. And the credibility...
But is it because she said almost never? I mean, what if you know, Dr. Benatz, you know, came and he was highly qualified and he said, based on 15 psychological studies, you know, victims almost never do X and they almost never do Y, and so it shouldn't surprise you, right? You said you wouldn't have a problem with that necessarily. So what precisely is your problem with this particular woman coming in and testifying as she did? I mean, narrow and focus with laser-like precision as to what the answer is.
Yes, Your Honor, she wasn't qualified to give that opinion.
And she wasn't qualified because?
Because her underlying methodology was not reliable.
Because
all she was testifying is to what other people told her. And she conducted no individual quality control on her own as to whether, in fact, this was true, whether, in fact, these folks were, you know, had actually been proven to be victims of sexual assault. And
I mean, what would have happened if the government, if she'd answered the defense counsel's question as to how many people had been convicted, right? You would have objected to that being answered, wouldn't you have? I mean, you would have objected if she said every single one of them was convicted.
If she had said that, but she wasn't going to say that, Your Honor, as is the 39A on that.
But I'm saying if she could have said that, if she could have said every one of these people that I interviewed, the person that assaulted them was convicted, then would you say her methodology was sufficient and reliable?
No, Your Honor, and I think where the failure was in Ms. Falk's case was that the military judge stopped that defense from cross-examining and exposing the unreliability of that in front of the panel. Captain Carter talked about, she cited one-third and one-fourth. That's exactly the type of information which should have gone to the panel because it determines how much weight they should give to her testimony to begin with. And the government talks a lot about Johnson. They rely on Johnson. In Johnson, the military judge specifically instructed the panel to disregard that information about that she wasn't, that was outside the realm that she wasn't supposed to give.
Can I ask you to go back to the question that Chief Judge Baker asked you at the beginning, which when you answered him, you still gave him four different answers, right? Which is, if you have one argument to make, right, just one, and the answer can't be a compilation of four, so you have one argument to make, what's your argument as to why you should win?
Your Honor, because the government...
And I'm going to stop you if you add two or three together.
Yes, Your Honor. My one answer would be, Your Honor, that the government presented evidence which they themselves admitted their expert was not qualified to give. Subject to your questions, that concludes my argument.
All right. Thank you. The case is now submitted. We thank both counsel, and we'll stand in recess until 10:20. Thank you very much.
All right. Court stands in recess until 10:20 a.m.